Detroit. Census figures in 1790 showed the non-Indian population at 73,000 Kentuckians and 35,000 Tennesseans, while the Old Northwest, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, boasted 5,000, with numbers rising daily. Counting the pre-1790 residents, the combined American population in all areas between the Appalachian Crest and the Mississippi River numbered an impressive 250,000. As one traveler later observed, "Old America seems to be breaking up and moving westward. We are seldom out of sight as we travel on this grand track towards the Ohio of family groups behind and before us." Add to these numerous stages loaded to the utmost and the innumerable travelers on horseback, on foot, and in light wagons, and you have before you a scene of bustle and business extending over 300 miles, which is truly wonderful. On the eastern seaboard, the Confederation Congress watched the Great Migration with interest and concern. Nearly everyone agreed that Congress would have to create a national domain, devise a method for surveying and selling public lands, formulate an Indian policy, and engage in diplomatic negotiations with the British and Spanish in the Old Northwest and Southwest. Most important, Congress had to devise some form of territorial government plan to establish the rule of law in the trans-Appalachian West. Nearly everyone agreed these measures were necessary, but that was about all they agreed to. Western lands commanded much of Congress's attention because of the lingering problem of national domain. The articles remained unratified because some of the landed states still refused to surrender their see-to-see claims to the central government, and Maryland refused to ratify the document until they did. This logjam cleared in 1781 when Virginia, thanks to Jefferson's influence, finally ceded her western claims to Congress. Maryland immediately ratified the articles, officially making the document, at long last, the first Constitution of the United States. Although one state, Georgia, continued to claim its western lands, the remaining states chose to ignore the problem. Congress immediately set to work on territorial policy, creating legal precedents that the nation follows to this day. Legislators saw the ramifications of their actions with remarkably clear eyes. They dealt with a huge question. If Congress, like the British Parliament before it, established colonies in the West, would they be subservient to the new American mother country or independent? Congress rejected the British model, making the United States the first nation to allow for gradual democratization of its colonial empire. Jefferson, in particular, was concerned that settlers in the new land, unless properly treated and ensured representation, would soon themselves declare independence from their mother country. He wrote the deed that conveyed the western region be made into states having the same rights of sovereignty, freedom, and independence, the same as the original 13 states. He urged Madison to hurry the bill through the assembly, fearing the people in the western territories will separate themselves. As chair of Congress's Territorial Government Committee, Jefferson played a major role in the drafting of the Ordinance of 1784. Jefferson proposed to divide the Trans-Appalachian West into 16 new states, all of which would eventually enter the Union on an equal footing with the 13 original states. Ever the scientist, Jefferson arranged his new states on a neat grid of latitudinal and longitudinal boundaries and gave them fanciful, classical, patriotic, and Indian names. Carinesus, Metropotamia, Saratoga, Assinipia, and Sylvania. He directed that the Appalachian Mountains should forever divide the slave from the free states, institutionalizing free soil on the western frontier. Although this radical idea did not pass in 1784, it combined with territorial self-governance and equality and became the foundation of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Jefferson also applied the scientific method to a land policy component of the Ordinance of 1784. he called for the use of a grid system in the survey of public lands. Moreover, Jefferson aimed to use the national domain to immediately place free or at least cheap land in the hands of actual settlers, not the national government. His and David Howell's land policy proposal reflected their agrarianism and acknowledgement of widespread de facto preemption, squatters' rights, on the American frontier that was later codified into law. As economist Hernando de Soto has argued in The Mystery of Capital, the American preemption process gave common people a means to get a legal title to land, which was an early basis for capital formation. This kind of liberal and legal land policy is not present in 90% of the world even to this day. By 1785, however, Jefferson had left Congress, and nationalists were looking to public lands sales as a source for much-needed revenue. A congressional committee chaired by nationalist Massachusetts delegate Rufus King began to revise Jefferson's proposal. Borrowing the basic policies of northeastern colonial expansion, Congress overlaid the New England township system on the national map. Surveyors were to plot the West into thousands of townships, each containing 36 640-acre sections. Setting aside one section of each township for local school funding, Congress aimed to auction off townships at a rate of $2 per acre with no credit offered. Legislators hoped to raise quick revenue in this fashion because only entrepreneurs could afford the minimum purchase, but the system broke down as squatters, speculators, and other wily frontiersmen avoided the provisions and snapped up land faster than the government could survey it. Despite these limitations, the 1785 law set the stage for American land policy, charting a path toward cheap land, scientifically surveyed with valid title, that would culminate in the Homestead Act of 1862. To this day, an airplane journey over the neatly surveyed, square-cornered townships of the American West proves the legacy of the Confederation Congress's Land Ordinance of 1785. Moving to Indian policy in 1786, Congress set precedents that remain in place, the most important of which was the recognition of Indian right of soil, a right that could be removed only through military conquest or bona fide purchase. No one pretended that this policy intended that the laws would favor the Indians, and certainly Congress had no pro-Indian faction at the time. Rather, nationalist leaders wanted an orderly and, if possible, peaceful settlement of the West, which could only be accomplished if the lands obtained by Indians came with unimpeachable title deeds. Congress then appointed Indian commissioners to sign treaties with the Iroquois, Ohio Valley, and southeastern civilized tribes. Treaty sessions soon followed at Fort Stanwix, Hopewell, and other sites. Obviously, these agreements did not solve the Indian problem, nor did they produce universal peaceful relations between the races. On the other hand, the Indian Ordinance of 1786 did formalize the legal basis of land dealings between whites and Indians. Most important, it established the two fundamental principles of American Indian policy: the sovereignty of the national government versus the states in orchestrating Native American affairs, and the right of soil, which also necessitated written contractual agreements. To reiterate the points made in earlier chapters, the concept that land could be divided and privately owned was foreign to some, though not all, tribes, making the latter principle extremely important if only for claims against the government that might arise generations later. Congress returned to the territorial government question in a 1787 revision of Jefferson's Ordinance of 1784. Again, Rufus King, Nathan Dane, and the Nationalists led the effort to stabilize westward expansion. The Nationalist imprint in the ordinances of 1786 and 1787 showed a marked difference from the point of view of agrarian Whigs like Jefferson and David Howell. Dane and King acknowledged the inevitability of westward expansion, but they preferred that it be slow, peaceful, and regulated by the government. Although not all their ideas were feasible, they nevertheless composed the basis of the American territorial system. Even in 21st century America, when a territory becomes part of the American Empire and, in some cases, seeks statehood, for example, Alaska, Hawaii, and perhaps someday Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands, that territory's governmental evolution is charted under the terms remarkably similar to those established by the Northwest Ordinance. Only a few states, Texas, an independent republic that never went through territorial status, West Virginia, which was admitted directly to the Union during the Civil War, and Hawaii, which was annexed, did not come into the Union in this process. The Northwest Ordinance established a territorial government north of the Ohio River under a governor, former Continental Army General and staunch Federalist Arthur St. Clair was soon appointed, and judges whom the president chose with legislative approval. Upon reaching a population of 5,000, the landholding white male citizens could elect a legislature and a non-voting congressional representative. Congress wrote a Bill of Rights into the ordinance and stipulated, a la Jefferson's 1784 proposal, that no slavery or involuntary servitude would be permitted north of the Ohio River. Yet the slavery issue was not clear-cut, and residents themselves disagreed over the relevant clause, Article 6. William Henry Harrison, Indiana's first territorial governor, mustered a territorial convention in Vincennes in 1802 for the purpose of suspending Article 6 for 10 years. Petitioners in Illinois also sought to amend the clause. It is easy to miss the enormity of the efforts to undercut the slavery prohibition in the Northwest, which became the basis for the popular sovereignty arguments of the 1850s, and indeed for the infamous Dred Scott ruling of 1857. In a nutshell, the pro-slavery forces argued that the U.S. Congress had no authority over slaves in, say, Indiana. Only the citizens of Indiana did. In that context, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 put the issue of slavery on the front burner. More than that, it spoke directly to the divisive issue of state sovereignty, which, fortunately, the people of the Northwest Territory and the Congress decided in favor of the federal authority. The ordinance produced other remarkable insights for the preservation of democracy in newly acquired areas. For example, it provided that between 3 and 5 new states could be organized from the region, thereby avoiding having either a giant superstate or dozens of small states that would dominate the Congress. When any potential state achieved a population of 60,000, its citizens were to draft a constitution and apply to Congress for admission into the federal union. During the ensuing decades, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin entered the Union under these terms. The territorial system did not always run smoothly, but it endured. The Southwest Ordinance of 1789 instituted a similar law for the Old Southwest, but permitting slavery in those territories, and Kentucky, 1791, and Tennessee, 1796, preceded Ohio into the Union. But the central difference remained that Ohio, unlike the southern states, abolished slavery, and thus the Northwest Ordinance joined the Missouri Compromise of 1820 and the Compromise of 1850 as the first of the great watersheds in the raging debate over North American slavery. Little appreciated at the time was the moral tone and the inexorability forced on the nation by the ordinance. If slavery was wrong in the territories, was it not wrong everywhere? The relentless logic drove the South to adopt its states' rights position after the drafting of the Constitution, but the direction was already in place. If slavery was morally right, as Southerners argued, it could not be prohibited in the territories, nor could it be prohibited anywhere else. Thus, from 1787 onward, though few recognized it at the time, the South was committed to the expansion of slavery, not merely its perpetuation where it existed at the time. And this was a moral imperative, not a political one. Popular notions that the Articles of Confederation Congress was a bankrupt, do-nothing body that sat by helplessly as the nation slid into turmoil are thus clearly refuted by Congress's creation of America's first Western policies legislating land sales, interaction with Indians, and territorial governments. Quite the contrary, Congress under the Articles was a legislature that compared favorably to other revolutionary machinery, such as England's Long Parliament, the French Radicals' Reign of Terror, the Latin American Republics of the early 1800s, and more recently the legislatures of the Russian, Chinese, Cuban, and Vietnamese communists. Unlike those bodies, several of which slid into anarchy, the Confederation Congress boasted a strong record. After waging a successful war against Britain and negotiating the Treaty of Paris, it produced a series of domestic acts that can only be viewed positively. The Congress also benefited from an economy rebuilding from wartime stresses, for which the Congress could claim little credit. Overall, though, the record of the Articles of Confederation Congress must be reevaluated upward, and perhaps significantly so. Two streams of liberty. Well before the Revolutionary War ended, strong differences of opinion existed among the Whig patriots. While the majority favored the radical state constitutions, the Articles of Confederation, and legislative dominance, a minority viewpoint arose. Detractors of radical constitutionalism voiced a more moderate view, calling for increased governmental authority and more balance between the executive, judicial, and legislative branches at both the state and national levels. During this time, the Radicals called themselves Federalists because the Articles of Confederation created the weak federal union they desired. Moderates labeled themselves Nationalists, denoting their commitment to a stronger national state. These labels were temporary, and by 1787, the Nationalists would be calling themselves Federalists and, in high irony, labeling their Federalist opponents Anti-Federalists. The Nationalist faction included Robert Morris, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Henry Knox, Rufus King, and their leader, Alexander Hamilton. These men found much wanting at both the state and national levels of government. They wanted to broaden the taxation and commercial regulatory powers of the Confederation Congress while simultaneously curtailing what they perceived as too much democracy at the state level. "America must clip the wings of a mad democracy," wrote Henry Knox. John Adams, retreating from his 1776 radicalism, concurred, "There never was a democracy that did not commit suicide. The people," Hamilton snorted, "the people is a great beast." Yet it should not be assumed that this anti-democratic language was monarchical or anti-revolutionary in nature, because Hamilton himself would also refer to the majesty of the multitude. Rather, the nationalist criticism reflected a belief in republicanism as a compromise before the tyranny of a monarch and what James Madison feared to be a potential tyranny of the majority. It was a philosophical stance dating back to Aristotle's distinction between a polis, good government by the many, and a democracy, abusive government of the many. Nationalists concluded that the spirit of 76 had become too extreme. At the state level, nationalists attacked the actions of all-powerful legislatures produced by expanded suffrage. They were also disturbed when seven states issued inflated currency and enacted legislation that required creditors to accept these notes, leading to scenes in which debtors literally chased fleeing creditors, attempting to pay them in spurious money. Additional debtors' laws granted extensions to farmers who would have otherwise lost their property through default during the post-war recession. Reaction to the state-generated inflation is explainable in part by the composition of the nationalists, many of whom were themselves creditors in one way or another. But an underlying concern for contractual agreements also influenced the nationalists, who saw state meddling in favor of debtors as a potentially debilitating violation of property rights. When it came to government under the Articles, nationalists aimed their sharpest jabs at the unstable leadership caused by term limits and annual elections. A role existed for a strong executive and permanent judiciary, they contended, especially when it came to commercial issues. The Confederation's economic policy, like those of the states, had stifled the nation's enterprise, a point they hoped to rectify through taxation of international commerce through import tariffs. Significantly, the new nationalists largely espoused the views of Adam Smith, who, although making the case for less government interference in the economy, also propounded a viable but limited role for government in maintaining a navy and army capable of protecting trade lanes and national borders. Weaknesses in the Articles also appeared on the diplomatic front, where America was being bullied despite its newly independent status. The British refused to evacuate their posts in the Old Northwest, claiming the region would fall into anarchy under the United States. Farther south, the Spanish flexed their muscles in the lower Mississippi Valley, closing the port of New Orleans to the booming American flatboat and keelboat trade. Congress sent nationalist John Jay to negotiate a settlement with Spain's Don Diego de Guardaquí. Far from intimidating the Spaniards, Jay offered to suspend American navigation of the Mississippi for 25 years in return for a trade agreement favorable to his northeastern constituents. Western anti-nationalists were furious, but had to admit that without an army or navy, the Confederation Congress was powerless to coerce belligerent foreign powers. Nevertheless, Congress could not swallow the Jay-Guardaquí Treaty and scrapped it. Mike Fink, King of the River. The complicated issues of politics in the 1780s were paralleled by related real-life dramas far removed from the scenes of government. For example, shortly after John Jay negotiated with Spain's Don Diego de Guardaquí over American trading rights on the inland rivers, Big Mike Fink was pioneering the burgeoning river traffic of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. Fink gained such a mighty reputation during America's surge west of the Appalachians that he was dubbed King of the River. Back in the days before steam power, the produce of the American frontier, pork, flour, corn, animal skins, and whiskey, was shipped up and down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers on thousands of flatboats and keelboats. Flatboats were crude, flat-bottomed craft that could travel only downstream. Keelboats were sleeker, 60-foot craft that could be pulled upstream by the Herculean efforts of their crewmen. Early rivermen lived hard lives, enduring the hazards of ice, fog, snags, sandbars, waterfalls, and even Indian attacks as they plied their trade in the early West. Upon sale of their cargoes in Natchez or New Orleans, most rivermen walked back to their Ohio Valley homes via the Natchez Trace, braving the elements and attacks from outlaws. Mike Fink so captured the public imagination that oral legends of his exploits spread far and wide and ultimately found their way into print in newspapers and almanacs. According to these stories, Fink was half horse, half alligator, and could outrun, outhop, outjump, throw down, drag out, and lick any man in the country. In some tales, Fink outfoxed wily farmers and businessmen, cheating them out of money and whiskey. He could ride dangerous bulls, one of which, he said, drug me over every briar and stump in the field. The most famous and oft-repeated Mike Fink story is one in which he, a la William Tell, shoots a whiskey cup off a friend's head. These are good yarns, and some of them were no doubt true. But who was the real Mike Fink? Born near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the headwaters of the Ohio River around 1770, Fink grew into a fine woodsman, rifleman, and frontier scout. He took up boating around 1785 and rose in the trade. He mastered the difficult business of keel boating, poling, rowing, sailing, and cordelling, pulling via a rope winch, keelboats upstream for hundreds of miles against the strong currents of the western rivers. Fink plied the Ohio and Mississippi during the very time frontier Americans angrily disputed Spanish control of America's downriver trade. By the early 1800s, Fink owned and captained two boats headquartered at Wheeling, West Virginia. Working his way west, Fink's career paralleled that of American expansion into the Mississippi Valley, while at the same time reflecting the coarse and violent nature of the American frontier. One of the few documented accounts of the historic Mike Fink is an early 19th century St. Louis newspaper story of his shooting the heel off a black man's foot. Responding to an advertisement in the March 22, 1822 St. Louis, Missouri Republican, which called for 100 young men to ascend the Missouri River to its source and establish a fur trading outpost in the Montana country, Fink was hired to navigate one of the company's keelboats up the Missouri, working alongside the legendary mountain man Jedediah Smith. An 1823 feud between Fink and two fellow trappers flared into violence that led to Fink's murder. Thus ended the actual life of the King of the River. But mythical Mike Fink had only begun to live. He soon became a folk hero whose name was uttered in the same breath with Daniel Boone, Andrew Jackson, and Davy Crockett. Celebrated in folklore and literature, Mike Fink's legend was assured when he made it into a 1956 Walt Disney movie. Nationalists held mixed motives in their aggressive critique of government under the Articles of Confederation. Honest champions of stronger government, they advanced many valid political, economic, military, and diplomatic ideas. Their opponents, perhaps correctly, called them reactionaries who sought to enrich their own merchant class. True, critics of the Articles of Confederation represented the commercial and cosmopolitan strata of the new nation. It just so happened that, for the most part, the long-range interests of the young United States coincided with their own. Throughout the early 1780s, nationalists unsuccessfully attempted to amend the Articles. Congress's Treasury Chief, Robert Morris, twice proposed a 5% impost tax, a tariff, but Rhode Island's solo resistance defeated the measure. Next, he offered a plan for a privately owned national bank to manage fiscal matters, and again, 12 states concurred, but not Rhode Island. Matters came to a boil in September 1786 when delegates from the five states bordering the Chesapeake Bay convened in Annapolis, Maryland, ostensibly to discuss shared commercial problems. The nationalists among the Annapolis Convention delegates proceeded to plant the seed of a peaceful counter-revolution against the Confederation Congress. Delegates unilaterally called for a new meeting of representatives of all 13 states to occur in Philadelphia in the spring of 1787. Although these nationalists no doubt fully intended to replace the existing structure, they worded their summons to Philadelphia in less threatening tones, claiming only to seek agreements on commercial issues and to propose changes that may require a correspondent adjustment of other parts of the federal system. The broadest interpretation of this language points only to amending the Articles of Confederation, although Hamilton and his allies had no such aim. They intended nothing less than replacing the Articles with a new federal constitution. In that light, Rufus King captured the attitudes of many of these former revolutionaries when he wrote of the delegate selection, For God's sake, be careful who are the men. The fly in the ointment when it came to making changes to the articles was the clause requiring unanimous consent among the states to ratify any alterations, which made any plan to change them without such consent illegal. Consequently, the Constitutional Convention and the federal constitution it produced technically were illegal. Yet this was a revolutionary age. Only 10 years earlier, these same founders had illegally replaced one form of government with another. It is not incongruous, then, that these same patriots would seek to do so again. And, to their credit, they planned for this change to be nonviolent. Still, the Nationalists' call to Philadelphia might have failed, but for one event that followed on the heels of the Annapolis Convention. Shay's Rebellion, a tax revolt in Massachusetts, provided the catalyst that convinced important leaders to attend the Philadelphia meeting. Unlike other states, Massachusetts had not passed debtors' laws, and thousands of farmers faced loss of their lands to unpaid creditors. Daniel Shays, a Pelham, Massachusetts farmer and a retired captain in the Continental Army, organized farmers to resist the foreclosures, and under his leadership, armed bands closed the courts of western Massachusetts, ostensibly to protect their property. Creditors, however, saw their own property rights in jeopardy. By January 1787, Shays' rebels were on the run. A lone battle in the rebellion occurred at Springfield, in which Massachusetts militia, under Continental General Benjamin Lincoln, attacked the Shaysites and dispersed them. After the smoke cleared, 4 men lay dead, and Shays had fled the state. Lincoln's troops arrested some of the rebels, 18 of whom were tried and sentenced to death, although only 2 were hanged and the rest pardoned. But the government hardly wanted the blood of these farmers on its hands, so it worked out a compromise in which the governor commuted the men's sentences and freed them. Shays' rebellion, however, quickly transcended the military and legal technicalities of the case, becoming a cause célèbre among nationalists who pointed to the uprising as a prime example of the article's weak governance. Only a stronger government, they argued, could prevent the anarchy of the Shaysites from infecting America's body politic. Armed with a new battle cry, nationalists prepared to march to Philadelphia and conduct their own revolution. Although the general public had not yet discovered the aims of this revolutionary movement, Hamilton, Morris, Adams, Madison, Washington, and their fellow nationalists had formulated a distinct program. They aimed to replace the Articles with a new government that would, 1. Suborn state sovereignty to that of a national government, 2. Replace legislative dominance with a more balanced legislative executive judicial model, and 3. End the equality of states in congressional decision-making with a system of proportional representation. Most important, they planned to keep their deliberations secret, else, as Francis Hopkinson noted, no sooner will the chicken be hatched than everyone will be for plucking a feather. Under strict secrecy and with clear and noble goals, the American Revolution truly entered its second phase. A Republic, if you can keep it. Like the swing of a pendulum, momentum began to move in favor of the Nationalists' vision. Even the suspicious Confederation Congress issued a belated February authorization for the Philadelphia Convention, stipulating its sole and express purpose was revising the Articles of Confederation, not replacing them. State legislatures appointed delegates, and 12 of the 13 sent representatives. Rhode Island, again, was the exception, leading one legislator to refer to it as an unruly member, a reproach, and a byword. By May 14th, most of the 55 delegates, of whom 39 stayed the summer to draft and ratify the completed Constitution, had arrived at the meeting. Their names were so impressive that Jefferson, reading the list from Paris, called the convention an assembly of demigods. Nearly all of the delegates were nationalists. A few who opposed the principles of nationalism, most notably Melanchthon Smith, Luther Martin, and Abraham Yates, refused to sign the final document, eventually becoming anti-federalists. Some opponents, such as Patrick Henry, Sam Adams, and Richard Henry Lee, all key instigators of the American Revolution, had refused to attend in the first place. "I smell a rat," Henry fumed when informed of the convention. But he would have served himself and the nation if he had gone to personally investigate the odor. Other delegates who did attend were relatively young, averaging 42 years of age, in comparison to the older Whigs who had fomented the revolution nearly 20 years earlier. Aside from Washington, Franklin arrived with the most prominent reputation. His famous and familiar face, with his innovative bifocals and partially bald head, made him the best-known American in the world. He had become America's public philosopher, a trusted soul whose witticisms matched his insight. While in Philadelphia, Franklin, often posing as the voice of reason, brought a distinct agenda. He had only recently been named president of the Philadelphia Abolition Society, and in April 1787, he intended to introduce a proposal calling for the condemnation of slavery in the final document. Only through the persuasions of other northern delegates was he convinced to withdraw it. Franklin stood out from the other delegates in areas other than age as well. Nearly a third of the delegates had held commissions in the Continental Army, and most came from the upper tier of American society, planters, lawyers, merchants, and members of the professional class. They were, above all, achievers, and men well familiar with overcoming obstacles in order to attain success. Contrary to the critiques of historians such as Charles Beard and Howard Zinn, who saw only a monolithic class of men manipulating the convention, the fact that most of the delegates had been successful in enterprise was to their credit. Does any society truly want non-achievers, chronic failures, malcontents, and perennial pessimists drafting the rules by which all should live? Each had blemishes, and even the leaders, Hamilton, Franklin, Madison, Morris, James Wilson, Washington, who presided, possessed flaws, some of them almost insurmountable. But a rampant lust for power was not among them. As British historian Paul Johnson noted, "These were serious, sensible, undoctrinaire men gathered together in a pragmatic spirit to do something practical and looking back on 1,000 years of political traditions inherited from England, which had always stressed compromise and give and take." Sharp differences existed between factions within the convention, not only from the handful of anti-nationalists who threatened to disrupt any program that seemed odious, but also from the natural tensions between farmers and merchants, between slaveholders and free soil advocates, and between Northerners and Southerners. A final source of contention, though, arose between states with larger populations, such as Virginia, and those with smaller populations, such as New Jersey. Another split emerged, this one between Madison and Hamilton, over the occupations of those who would govern, Hamilton advocating a distinction between what he called the private interests, whether of individual members, states, or localities, and the public interest, which included the continuation of Republican ideals. It boiled down to a simple question: were men governed by altruistic motives or base self-interest? Washington thought the latter. It was unrealistic, he contended, to expect ordinary people to be influenced by any other principles but those of interest. Hamilton agreed, arguing that lawyers comprised the only class with no immediate economic stake in matters. Offering a suggestion that tends to make modern Americans shudder, Hamilton said that while the state legislatures should rightly be dominated by merchants, planters, and farmers, the national legislature should be populated by lawyers. For all his insight, French minister Talleyrand called him the greatest of the choice and master spirits of the age, Hamilton failed to foresee that by the middle of the 20th century, through tort litigation, lawyers would come to have an immediate and extremely lucrative interest in certain types of legislation, and that every law passed by the National Congress would require a geometrical increase in the numbers of attorneys needed to decipher and attempt to evade it. The ultimate irony is that no matter which group triumphed on the other compromise issues, it was the inexorable demand generated by the need to write laws and the concomitant legalisms that gradually pushed the farmers and merchants out of the halls of the legislatures and pulled the lawyers in. Only toward the end of the 20th century, when it was almost too late, did Americans start to appreciate the dangers posed by a bar that had virtually unlimited access to the lawmaking apparatus. The division over proportional representation versus state representation formed the basis for two rival plans of government, the so-called Virginia Plan and the New Jersey Plan. Madison, Washington, and Edmund Randolph had drafted the Virginia Plan, an extreme nationalist program that aimed to scrap the Articles and create a powerful Republican government in its place. Their proposal called for an end to state sovereignty and the creation of a viable national state comprised of three equal branches. A president would serve alongside federal judges with lifetime terms and a bicameral legislature in which the lower house would be elected proportionately and the upper house would be selected from a list of nominees sent from the state legislatures on the basis of equal representation for the states. According to their plan, the lower house would give the highly populated states more representation. Finally, the Virginia Plan proposed a veto power over state laws, so that, as John Jay said, the states would lose sovereignty and be viewed in the same light in which counties stand to the state of which they are parts, merely as districts. Even the nationalist-dominated Philadelphia Convention opposed such sweeping change. In June, opponents rallied around William Patterson's New Jersey Plan, calling for a beefed-up confederation type of central government. Small states agreed that the national government needed muscle, most especially the powers to tax internally and externally. They also proposed three, but much less powerful, branches of government. Congress was to appoint a Supreme Court and plural executive committee, creating the semblance of a three-branch system. Its most important feature, though, lay in what the New Jersey Plan rejected: proportional representation. Instead, Patterson proposed a unicameral Congress with equal representation for each state, with all the powers of the Confederation Congress. Delegates began to debate the disparate plans, but all realized the Virginia Plan would triumph as long as its adherents were willing to compromise over the proportional representation feature and the national veto of state laws. Several compromises ensued, the most important of which, the Connecticut Compromise, or Great Compromise, concerned proportional representation. Divisions between large and small state factions dissolved as each gained one legislative body tailored to its liking. The House of Representatives, in which members would be elected directly by the people, would be based on population determined by a federal census. It represented the people in the broadest sense, and terms of the members were kept at a brief 2 years, requiring representatives to face the voters more often than any other elected group. On the other hand, the Senate would represent the interests of the states, with senators chosen by state legislatures for 6-year terms, one-third of whom would come up for election every 2 years. Clearly, the structure of the compromise not only addressed the concerns of each side, but it spoke to another overarching concern: that change be difficult and slow. No matter what burning issue consumed Americans, at any given time, only one-third of the Senate would be up for reappointment by the state legislature, providing a break on emotion-driven legislation. Their wisdom in this matter has been magnified over time. Issues that one moment seemed momentous faded from popular interest in years or even months. Slow the process down, the founders would say, and many problems will just disappear without laws. There was another touch of genius to the numerous staggered terms and differing sets of requirements. As the French observer Alexis de Tocqueville later pointed out, when elections recur only at long intervals, the state is exposed to violent agitation every time they take place. Parties then exert themselves to the utmost to gain a price which is so rarely within their reach, and as the evil is almost irremediable for the candidates who fail, everything is to be feared from their disappointed ambition. For a House seat, the loser of a contest could try again in 2 years, and after the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, at least one of a state's Senate seats could be contested every 4 years. No matter how bad the election and how massive the defeat, those out of power knew that political winds changed, and with the single-member district system, a person only had to win by one vote to win the seat. Thus, the system encouraged a fundamental political patience that proved so successful that the Democrats, in the late 1800s, would go 62 years from Lincoln to Franklin Roosevelt and elect only 3 Democratic presidents, one of them Grover Cleveland, twice. While the Republicans in the late 20th century went 40 years without a majority in the House of Representatives. In each case, the party out of power never came close to desperation or violence. Indeed, the opposite occurred, in which unceasing campaigning led to a new quest for office beginning the day after an election. If arguments over how to count representatives seemed at the top of the delegates' agenda, the disagreements often only masked an even more important but unspoken difference over slavery between the members from the northern and the southern sections. Virginia, Georgia, and the Carolinas had sufficient population at the time to block anti-slavery legislation under the new proposed House of Representatives structure. But already, ominous trends seemed to put the South on the path to permanent minority status. First, the precedents being set that same summer in the Northwest Ordinance suggested that slavery would never cross the Ohio River. More important, the competition posed by slave labor to free labor, combined with the large plantations guaranteed by primogeniture, made it a surety that immigration to southern states would consistently fall behind that of the north. Fewer immigrants meant fewer representatives, so the House was in jeopardy in the foreseeable future. To ensure a continued strong presence in the House, Southern delegates proposed to count slaves for the purposes of representation, a suggestion that outraged anti-slavery New Englanders who wanted only to count slaves toward national taxes levied on the states by the new government. Indians would not count for either representation or taxation. On June 11, 1787, Pennsylvanian James Wilson, who personally opposed slavery, introduced a compromise in which, for purposes of establishing apportionment and for taxation, a slave would be counted as 3/5 of a free inhabitant. The taxation aspect of the compromise was never invoked. The new Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, had a different plan in place, so it became a moot element of the compromise, essentially giving the South an inflated count in the House at no cost. At any rate, Wilson's phrase referred obliquely to free inhabitants and all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, and therefore slavery does not appear in the founding document. Because of the disturbing designation of a human as only 3/5 of the value of another, the South gained a substantial advantage through the agreement. Based on the percentage of voting power by the 5 major slave states, Georgia, Maryland, Virginia, and the 2 Carolinas, the differential appeared as follows. 1. Under the one state, one vote proposal, 38%. 2. Counting all inhabitants except Indians, 50%. 3. Counting only free inhabitants, 41%. And 4. Using the eventual 3/5 compromise numbers, 47%. This amounted to no less than a tacit agreement to permanently lock a slave bloc into near-majority status, perpetually protecting an institution the fathers liked to call temporary. Delegates to the Constitutional Convention thus arrived at the point at which they all knew they would come. Americans had twice before skirted the issue of slavery or avoided dealing with it. In 1619, when black slaves were first unloaded off ships, colonists had the opportunity and responsibility to insist on their emancipation, immediately and unconditionally. Yet they did not. Then again in 1776, when Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence and included the indictment of Great Britain's imposition of slavery on the colonies, pressure from South Carolina and other southern states forced him to strike it from the final version. Now, in 1787, the young republic had a third opportunity, perhaps its last without bloodshed, to deal with slavery. Its delegates did not. Several examples can be cited to suggest that many of the delegates thought slavery was already headed for extinction. In 1776, the Continental Congress had reiterated a prohibition in the non-importation agreement against the importation of African slaves, despite repealing the rest. During the war, various proposals were submitted to the Congress to offer freedom after the conflict to slaves who fought for the Revolution. Southern colonies blocked these. After the war, several northern states, including New Hampshire, 1779, Pennsylvania, 1780, Massachusetts, 1783, Rhode Island, 1784, and Connecticut, 1784, all expressly forbade slavery in their constitutions, adopted immediate or gradual emancipation plans, or had courts declare slavery unconstitutional. Most encouraging to anti-slave forces, however, in 1782, Virginia passed a law allowing slave owners discretion on freeing their slaves. Jefferson's own Notes on the State of Virginia imagined a time after 1800 when all slaves would be free, and Madison labeled pro-slavery arguments in 1790 shamefully indecent, calling slavery a deep-rooted abuse. Founders such as Hamilton, who helped start the New York Manumission Society, and Franklin, whose last major public debate involved a satirical lambasting of slavery, had established their anti-slavery credentials. Perhaps the most radical and surprising was Washington, who, alone among the Southern founders, projected an America that included both Indians and freed slaves as citizens in a condition of relative equality. He even established funds to support the children of his wife's slaves after her death, and his own slaves were freed in his last will and testament. The compromise over slavery did not come without a fight. Governor Morris, one of the most outspoken critics of slavery at the convention, attacked Wilson's fractional formula and asked of the slaves counted under the 3/5 rule, "Are they admitted as citizens? Then why are they not admitted on an equality with white citizens? Are they admitted as property? Then why is not other property admitted to the computation?" Massachusetts' Elbridge Gerry, later made famous for gerrymandering, the creative shaping of legislative districts for political gain, echoed this line of thinking, sarcastically asking why New Englanders would not be allowed to count their cattle if Georgians could count their slaves. Morris and others, including Jefferson, recognized that slavery promised to inject itself into every aspect of American life. Consider comity, the principle that one state accept the privileges and immunities of other states to encourage free travel and commerce between them. Article 4 required states to give full faith and credit to laws and judicial decisions of other states. Fugitives from justice were to be returned for trial to the state of the crime, for example. Almost immediately, conflicts arose when slaves escaped to northern states, which then refused to oblige southern requests for their return. Northern free blacks working in the merchant marine found themselves unable to disembark from their ships in southern ports for fear of enslavement, regardless of their legal status. 7 southern coastal states actually imprisoned free black sailors upon their arrival in port. At the time, however, the likelihood that the Southerners would cause the convention to collapse meant that the delegates had to adopt the 3/5 provision and deal with the consequences later. Realistically, it was the best they could do, although it would take 78 years, a civil war, and 3 constitutional amendments to reverse the 3/5 compromise. Modern historians have leaped to criticize the convention's decision, and one could certainly apply the colloquial definition of a compromise, doing less than what you know is right. Historian Joseph Ellis noted that the distinguishing feature of the Constitution when it came to slavery was its evasiveness. But let's be blunt. To have pressed the slavery issue in 1776 would have killed the Revolution. And to have pressed it in 1787 would have aborted the nation. When the ink dried on the final drafts, the participants had managed to agree on most of the important issues, and where they still disagreed, they had kept those divisions from distracting them from the task at hand. More important, the final document indeed represented all. In 560 roll calls, no state was always on the losing side, and each, at times, was part of the winning coalition. The framers were highly focused only on republic building, acting on the assumption that the Union was the highest good, and that ultimately all problems, including slavery, would be resolved if they could only keep the country together long enough. From the outset, the proceedings had perched perilously on the verge of collapse, making the final document indeed a miracle. When the convention ended, a woman buttonholed Franklin and asked what kind of government the nation had. "A republic, madam," Franklin replied, "if you can keep it." Federalism redefined. The completed Constitution represented a marked transformation in the American system of federalism. Defined in the early state constitutions, federalism meant a belief in separate governments, state, local, national, with state sovereignty. But the 1787 document turned the system upside down. Article 6 is an uncompromising statement that the laws of Congress are the supreme law of the land. Nevertheless, the purpose of this power, the preservation of liberty, remained evident throughout the document. This achievement required the delegates to endow the national government with a grant of specific, crucial, enumerated powers, including the authority to tax internally and externally via excises and tariffs, regulate foreign and interstate commerce, enforce contracts and property rights, raise armies in time of peace and war, make treaties, and make all laws necessary and proper to carry out these enumerated powers. Conversely, the states could no longer levy tariff and customs duties, coin and print money, or impair contracts via debtors' laws. These changes had crucial, far-reaching consequences. Under the three-branched federal government, which boasted the checks and balances for which the Federalists are rightly famous, Article 2 created a first-ever American national executive, the President of the United States. Elected indirectly by an electoral college, a shield against direct democracy and the domination of large population centers, the president was to serve a 4-year term with the option of perpetual re-election. He had authority to appoint all executive officials and federal judges with the approval of the Senate. Most important, the president was to be the major architect of American foreign policy, serving as the civilian commander-in-chief of the military forces and generally designing and executing foreign policy with the advice and consent of the Senate. Perhaps the most significant power given to the president was the executive's ability to veto congressional laws, subject to an override vote by Congress of 2/3 of the members, checking an otherwise mighty chief executive. In retrospect, despite concern raised at numerous points in America's history about an imperial presidency or a chief executive's wielding dictator's powers, the founders cleverly avoided the bloody instability that characterized many European nations like France, and the complete powerlessness that afflicted other foreign executives in places like the 1920s German Weimar Republic, site of the ill-considered splitting of executive authority. And if American presidents have aggrandized their power, it is largely because Congress, the courts, and most of all, the people, have willingly tolerated unconstitutional acquisitiveness. Ironically, this has occurred largely because of the very success and integrity of the process. Americans tend to think, despite frequent rhetoric to the contrary, that their leaders are not crooks, nor do they view them as power mad. The expansion of presidential power has, then, relied on the reality that, over time, the large majority of chief executives have done their job with a degree of humility, recognizing that the people remain sovereign in the end. Article 3 outlined a first-ever national judiciary. Federal judges would have the jurisdiction over all federal and interstate legal disputes. They would serve lifetime terms on condition of good behavior, and federal district courts would hear cases that could be appealed to federal circuit courts and, ultimately, to the Supreme Court of the United States. It is important to note that the Constitution in no way granted the federal courts the power of judicial review or an ultimate interpretive power over constitutional issues. Modern federal courts possess this huge power thanks to a long series of precedents beginning with the 1803 case of Marbury v. Madison. If the founders intended courts to possess this ultimate constitutional authority, they did not say so in the Constitution. Moreover, the federal court's authority was simultaneously checked by Congress's prerogative to impeach federal judges and the president for high crimes and misdemeanors, and a score of federal judges have been impeached and removed for offenses such as perjury as recently as the 1980s. Article 1, the most complex section of the Constitution, outlined the legislative branch of government. Congressmen would serve in the House of Representatives at a number proportional to their state's census figures, with the 3/5 clause intact. Representatives were to be elected directly by the people to 2-year terms, and, unlike the Confederation legislators, would have the option of perpetual re-election. The House members' chief authority, the power of the purse, descended from English and colonial precedent that tax and revenue measures had to emanate from the House of Representatives. The United States Senate is the second legislative component. Each state legislature elected 2 senators to serve 6-year terms with the option of perpetual re-election. Older than congressmen, senators ruled on bills passed by the House. Most important, the Senate had the approval power over all presidential appointees and also had ratification power over treaties. Both houses of Congress had to agree to declare war, and both were involved in removal of a president should the need arise. If a federal judge or the president committed high crimes and misdemeanors, articles of impeachment were to be voted out of the House, entailing only whether the alleged offenses reached the level of a high crime or misdemeanor, with the subsequent trial in the Senate, where senators served as jurors, strictly to determine guilt or innocence, not the gravity of the charge, which was already settled in the House. In both of the American impeachments as of 2014, the Senate had exceeded its constitutional authority by taking it upon itself to determine the gravity of the charges. For in both cases, the presidents were clearly guilty of the offenses. Surveying the Constitution, it is apparent that the nationalistic proponents of the Virginia Plan carried the day. No branch of the federal government had ultimate veto power over state legislation, as ardent nationalists advocated, and the Connecticut Compromise guaranteed a degree of state equality and power in the Senate. Yet the new Constitution marked a radical departure from the old Confederation model, and ultimately the Nationalists gained a veto of sorts through the extra-constitutional practice of judicial review. Opponents of centralized governmental authority were awed by the proposed document, and many doubted that the public would ratify and institute such a powerful central government so soon after overthrowing a monarch. The ratification stipulations enumerated in the final article thus carried great importance. How would the proposed governmental plan be debated and voted upon? Had the delegates followed the letter of the law, they would have been forced to submit the new constitution to the Confederation Congress in vain hope of the unanimous approval necessary to legally change the government. Of course, the Nationalists had no intention of obeying such a law. The Constitution instead contained its own new rules, calling each state to convene a special convention to debate and ratify or defeat the proposed governmental plan. If 9 states, not 13, ratified, the Constitution stipulated a new government would form. Having thus erected their grand plan to reshape American republicanism, the Nationalists returned to their home states to labor on behalf of its ratification. They did so well aware that the majority of Americans were highly suspicious of the term nationalism. Politically aware citizens thought of themselves as Whigs who backed the kind of federalism represented by the Confederation and the New Jersey Plan. In modern parlance, then, an image makeover was due. Nationalists shrewdly began, in direct contradiction to historical and constitutional precedent, to refer to themselves and their philosophy as federalism, not nationalism. Naturally, their Federalist opponents were aghast to hear their political enemies using the name Federalists for their own purposes, and worse, to hear the original federalism now redefined by the new federalists as anti-federalism. 2 rival political factions had formed, and the debate was on, but one already had perceived that control of the language is everything in politics. The ratification debate. The call for special ratifying conventions perfectly met the new Federalists' practical needs and ideological standards, for they suspected they would lose a popular vote, a vote in the Confederation Congress, or a vote of the state legislatures. Their only hope lay in a new venue where they had a level playing field and could use their powers of persuasion and growing command of the language of politics to build momentum. Their pragmatism dovetailed nicely with ideological precedents that turned the tables on the radicals, who had always argued that constitutional law was fundamental law and should be approved by specially selected governmental bodies, not common state legislatures. Nearly all of the new state constitutions were ratified by special conventions, which added to the leverage of precedent. Combining the ideological precedents with a rhetorical call for the sovereignty of the people, Federalist orators masterfully crafted a best-case scenario for their cause. They portrayed the special ratifying conventions as the best means of voicing the direct will of the people, and did this while studiously avoiding both a direct democratic vote and circumventing established elected bodies that stood against them. Their strategy was nothing less than a political tour de force. Each state proceeded to select delegates in different ways. In 4 states, voters directly elected delegates, whereas in the remainder, except Rhode Island, delegates served by a vote of state legislators or executive appointment. Only Rhode Island held a direct voter referendum on the Constitution. The Federalists knew that by moving quickly, they could frame the ratification process, and they won controlling majorities in 5 of the 13 states. Each of those states ratified the document within a few weeks. Using this initial support as a base, the Federalists continued to wage a propaganda campaign calling for sovereignty of the people over the state legislatures and outflanking the less articulate anti-Federalist majority. Much printer's ink has been spilled by historians arguing about the relative merits of the positions held by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. Prior to the 20th century, the Federalists held an elevated position in the minds of most Americans who were conscious of history. But in 1913, Charles Beard's Economic Interpretation of the Constitution delivered a broadside accelerated by economic principles of class struggle. Beard argued that the Federalists, acting on their own self-interest as planters and businessmen, greedily plotted to ensure their own economic supremacy. Using voting records of the delegates and examining their backgrounds, Beard concluded there was little concern for the public interest by these founders. In 1958, Forrest MacDonald dismantled Beard's economic determinism, only to be countered by Robert McGuire and Robert Ousfeldt's voting model analysis. It goes without saying that Beard is correct to identify the Anti-Federalists as farmers and middle-class working men, but this definition bridges a wide range of the population in 1787, including subsistence farmers in western Pennsylvania and upstate New York, alongside elite southern planters who led the movement. Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, William Grayson, and James Monroe, firm anti-Federalist leaders, were as wealthy as any in the Federalist camp, and were joined by Sam Adams, a chronic bankrupt, Melancton Smith, Luther Martin, and New York's George Clinton. Thomas Jefferson, arguably the best-known anti-Federalist of all, did not join the movement until the early 1790s, and at any rate was out of the country from 1787 to 88. And yet Beard's definitions and the complaints by Howard Zinn and his disciples wrongly assume that people were and are incapable of acting outside of self-interest. Had not the great Washington argued as much? Yet Washington had to look no further than his own life to realize the error of his position. He was on track to gain a general officer's commission in the British Army, replete with additional land grants for dutiful service to His Majesty. Instead, Washington threw it away to lead a ragtag army of malcontents into the snow of Valley Forge and the icy waters of the Delaware. Self-interest indeed. What self-interest caused Francis Lewis, a signer of the Declaration, to lose his properties and see his wife taken prisoner by the British? How does self-interest account for the fate of Judge Richard Stockton, a delegate from New Jersey to the Continental Congress who spent time in British jails and whose family had to live off charity, all because he dared sign the Declaration? On the other hand, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and others all stood to gain handsomely from the growing value of slave labor in the new Constitution, the one they opposed. In sum, no matter how Beard and his successors torture the statistics, they cannot make the Constitutional Convention scream class struggle. The debate was genuine. It was about important ideas, and men took positions